Happy 4th of July to our Bulwark Book Club fans. I hope you all are having a fantastic holiday. Before we jump into today's episode, I just wanted to alert everyone that Bill Kristol and I are going to be doing the August Book Club. We have chosen Pudd'nhead Wilson by Mark Twain. Now, I haven't read it, but it comes highly recommended by both of our spouses. And it is the story of, in the antebellum South, babies who are switched at birth, one black, one white. And it has gotten great praise from reviewers and critics over the years. So we are really looking forward to jumping in and talking about Mark Twain in general, a little American history. But it's a novel for August, for those of you going to the beach. I hope you can join us. I've looked it up. It is available all over the place and for free on Kindle if you want to get it that way. So hope you'll join us for that. And now on to this month's selection.
Political speech in newspapers was asking and calling for violence, and people were responding. So newspaper editors would call for mobs to attack their enemies, and they did. And there were threats of arson in Philadelphia. Death threats were delivered to the president's house. And so I think there was a genuine good faith concern about the role of political speech and violence, but it was then used by the Federalist Party and perverted for partisan gain. And so I think it's really essential that we don't dismiss the fear, because that is something I think some of it we can identify with. We just can't allow it to be thwarted in that way.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. This is our second or third Bulwark Book Club. So we are thrilled if you've had a chance to read the book that we're going to discuss. But even if you haven't, I know you'll find the conversation interesting. My guest is Lindsay Chervinsky, who is the author of Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. Lindsay, you are the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. So you are also an expert on Washington. And if you were writing about important precedents that were set at the beginning of our republic, why did you choose Adams? Why not the first precedent setter?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am a big Bulwark fan, a sometimes Bulwark contributor, and a great admirer of your work. So I'm thrilled to be here. And I love General Hertling. So I'm honored to follow in his footsteps with this book club. But I wrote a book about Washington's cabinet and the creation of the presidency, all of the precedents he established, and really the formation of a presidential institution. And then I was wondering about what to do next, and I started thinking about what would it look like to have someone else in that office? How did these precedents and norms survive? How did they become something powerful and tangible that we still have with us today? And that led me to John Adams. And then as I was starting to work on that book, I watched January 6th happen, as we all did. And I realized how much I was taking for granted the peaceful transfer of power. And I figured if I was, then probably some others were too. And started to explore where that really important practice came from. And it turns out that Adams was absolutely essential to the first couple of transitions. And that very much framed this book.
It taught me so much. One thing I have to confess is I kept having to remind myself as I was reading it that all of the action takes place in Philadelphia. We always think about presidents living and working in Washington, D.C. And of course, that didn't happen until very far into the Adams administration. He was the first president to live in the White House, you say, but he only lived there for what, 4 months before he was defeated for reelection and had to vacate. But you give such an evocative sense of what it was like in Philadelphia, of the distances involved, and so Adams comes into office, and the first thing that happens is that he is sort of besieged on all sides, both by his own party and by the other party. So tell us a little about that, if you would.
Absolutely. Well, I think the important thing to know, and it's hard for us to kind of envision this because we're reading history backwards, but in 1797, when John Adams took office, there were real, tangible, and frightening questions about whether or not this institution would work if anyone else was in it. The powers were enormous, and these were people that had very intentionally thrown off a monarchy. And so there were questions about whether or not anyone else could be trusted with that. There were questions about whether or not the institution would work and other nations would respect it, or whether it would work with the other institutions in our republic. And those fears and those concerns were ever present and very pervasive. And so Adams showed enormous political courage by just being willing to even go into this office to prove that someone else could do it, that the office was bigger than any one person. And that meant from the very beginning that he was grappling with how do you serve as president when your vice president is a person from the other party? Thomas Jefferson, of course, came in second. And at this point, that's how the Constitution picked the president and vice president. He was dealing with Washington's cabinet that he had inherited because there was no precedent of replacing your cabinet secretaries. And he had a lot of good reason to think that they would continue to be loyal to the office. And he was dealing with threats from France because tensions with France had been ratcheting up for the last couple of years. And they kind of broke over his head when he took office. And everyone kind of knew that this was going to happen. Thomas Jefferson was very happy to have lost that election and said that he felt like John Adams was left holding the bag. That's a direct quote. So this was an incredibly tumultuous time, and everyone knew it was going to be.
So one of our readers who sent in a question asked something very relevant to this. Norbert Pridge said, considering the trouble that Washington's cabinet caused for John Adams during his time in office, why didn't he sweep them out much earlier and nominate folks that were actually loyal to him?
Oh, this is such a good question. So he didn't initially, because Washington had had a really hard time getting people into office once that first batch of cabinet secretaries, the famous Hamilton-Jefferson duo, left. The positions were not nearly as prestigious as they are today. The pay was relatively low. You were going to be away from your home and families for months at a time because travel was difficult and dangerous. And you were opening yourself up to enormous political criticism at a time when many people were very wary of that. So he knew that if Washington had trouble, he was going to have trouble. He very much did not want to split the Federalist Party so early into his administration by replacing people. And again, he didn't know that that was necessary because he had never sat in on a single cabinet meeting. Washington didn't include him at all. And critically, Washington did not say, hey, you know, these guys are actually not great. You might want to consider someone else, which if I could ask Washington some questions, that would be one of them, top of the list.
So that is, and that is a pattern that is repeated by so many later presidents, right? Uh-huh. Not bringing their vice president in, not letting them know what's going on. Famously, Truman didn't even know about the Manhattan Project. I mean, there are many examples. Did Washington just not trust Adams? Didn't he like him? What was the, do you have any insight into why he kept him so much at arm's length for 8 years?
Yeah, there are two theories, and I find one far more compelling than the other. So the first was that the vice president was very much seen as part of the Senate at the time. The vice president sat in on every Senate session and was there to casting tie-breaking votes. So there's one argument that Washington thought would have seen that as a violation of separation of powers if he included John Adams in his cabinet meetings. I find that less compelling because he had no problem sending the Chief Justice on diplomatic missions. And that seems to me like a little bit of a blending of separation of powers to me. I think the far more compelling answer is that they had never been particularly close. Adams had criticized some of Washington's choices, especially in 1776 with the military. And rightfully so, Washington made some battlefield mistakes. And while Washington was very willing to hear criticism face to face, if you said it publicly, then he had a hard time forgiving that. And so he definitely held that against Adams. But I think the most pressing issue was in the summer of 1789, when they were trying to figure out what to call the president. Adams had suggested a very ostentatious title, something like his elected majesty and protector of our liberties, which does not roll off the tongue. And I think he had understandable reason for that, because he had just come from the court of St. James and had been at Versailles and had seen the majesty of those institutions. And he worried that foreign representatives would come to the United States and think, what is this podunk, nothing backwater nation? And so he thought a title would help. And that was a very unpopular decision. It very much undercut his political support. And I think Washington came to distrust his political judgment. But that's kind of reading between the lines. We don't have a great answer there. Right. But to close off the question about Adams' cabinet, he certainly could have replaced the cabinet secretaries earlier than he did. He didn't fire Timothy Pickering until May of 1800. I think he was worried with the possible threat of France, what it would do to tear apart the Federalist Party. And he was desperately trying to hold the Union together. And there were real questions about whether or not the president had the right to do so. The Constitution doesn't specify anything about the department secretaries other than they will eventually exist. And the legislation creating the department secretaries in the summer of 1789 doesn't say how they were to be removed, because Congress couldn't agree. So they just punted on the decision. And Washington had never fired a cabinet secretary. If he was displeased with them, they just resigned in horror. And so there was a real legal question about whether or not he had the right to. And in fact, when Adams did appoint John Marshall as Timothy Pickering's replacement, the Senate debated for a couple of days whether they would accept it. And they ultimately decided that Marshall was the best replacement that they could get. And so they accepted the appointment. But that precedent was then ultimately upheld in the 1920s by the Supreme Court. But there was a lot of legal questions around the decision.
So I had always thought of the Federalists in kind of vague terms, you know, that they were the sort of New England pro-business, pro-Britain party, as opposed to the Republicans, who were pro-France and slave owners and whatever. But this book really gets into the intra-Federalist fighting. And so whereas one might have thought that with a Federalist president like John Adams, that he would be hostile to France, in fact, the arch-Federalists in his cabinet were, and Hamilton is behind the scenes, like all these cabinet members you point out in the book are reporting to Hamilton. They're mm-hmm. all like in correspondence with him, really colluding with him. And they really want a war with France, but Adams is keen to keep the U.S. out of a war, which, by the way, seems very consistent with Washington's foreign policy. It's a shame Washington didn't give him a little bit more support in this. But anyway, what's your sense of that?
Absolutely. I think this was part of the story that for me was the most fascinating, and in some ways, one of the things that was so relevant to today about this book in terms of the parallels between the 1790s and now. If Washington and Adams had had a telephone, I think things would have gone a lot better, because they were actually so aligned on so many things. And the distance between them allowed the cabinet, with Hamilton's participation, to really pit them against each other and collude to achieve what they wanted to achieve. And that was that this new army that Congress had built to defend the United States against a potential French invasion was essentially a spoil system for the Federalist Party. And Hamilton had these grand notions of marching it south through Virginia to crush the Democratic Republicans and then go on to South America and stir up some rebellions for good measure. So when I'm talking about this book, I'll sometimes say that Adams really slow rolled the creation of the army and kind of tried to put up obstacles to its evolution. And that sounds like something we would never want a president to do. But I also say, this is not the army that we have today. This is not the army we want. It was a very partisan organization. And Adams had the incredible good sense to know that a war would be potentially fatal to the nation, especially with, this is Napoleon's France at this point. So this is a massive army. And he had been abroad, and he had the incredible diplomatic experience and expertise to know that European nations did not care at all about what happened to the United States and were always acting in their own best interests.
So he was able to pursue diplomacy, and that really did fracture the party. But what I found so interesting is because it was a very weak party, these are not the political parties of, you know, like the 1980s or even today. The moment he pursued diplomacy, the extreme wing of the party turned on him and started referring to him as an evil to be endured and undermining his reelection campaign, undermining his foreign policy, anything that they could do to make his presidency weaker. But the rhetoric they used about people not being Federalist enough or not being strong enough against their enemies or their opponents reminds me so much of their rhetoric today, in that we have a weak party, we have weak parties, such that the extreme voices are the ones often attacking the moderates.
Yeah, so interesting. Okay, so I'm fascinated by the relationships. So we've probed a little bit the relationship between Washington and Adams. Can we talk for a minute? You refer to this about the relationship between Washington and Jefferson, because there was this Mazzei letter. Am I mispronouncing that?
I think it's Mazzei.
Mazzei, okay.
But my Italian is not great, so who knows?
So this is published. This is a private letter Jefferson wrote to a friend who was in Italy at the time, in Pisa. And it is pretty scurrilous, pretty horrible about Washington. And I'm just curious, like, okay, so he never denied being the author of this. Jefferson did not deny it. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking, did Washington know about this? How did it affect their relationship?
He absolutely knew. And this is, again, where Washington was very tolerant of criticism in private, especially if it was to his face. If you were honest with him in private about what you thought, he was very accepting of that and even welcomed it in his cabinet. But if you publicized the criticism or you went behind his back, then he never really forgave that and could be quite thin-skinned. So at this point, by the time Adams was president, Washington and Jefferson were kind of on the outs anyway. Jefferson, of course, had started an opposition newspaper to the Washington administration while he was still acting as Secretary of State, which Washington knew and tolerated for a shocking amount of time, and didn't demand that Jefferson fire the person that was responsible for this newspaper. He permitted a really surprising degree of opposition from within the administration because he saw the value in having both Jefferson and Hamilton there to balance one another. After Jefferson left as Secretary of State, he then really became the leader of this new opposition party and was quite critical of the Washington administration. So their relationship was further strained. They managed to continue to send letters back and forth occasionally, as long as they focused on safe subjects like farming and agriculture and not talking about anything political. But the Mazzei letter was really probably one of the last straws. And after that, they didn't speak much. And while this is a little bit of, we're not sure how much of this is myth and how much of this is accurate, after Washington died, Jefferson did go visit Martha. And she said it was one of the worst days of her life because she never forgave him either.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Well, it's a good reminder. We are often much more forgiving of those who trespass against us and less forgiving of those who trespass against our loved ones.
Absolutely. You also relate that though Washington was pretty sparing in what he would say to Adams, that Martha did say to him on the occasion of his inauguration that the president and she were both very happy about the outcome of the election or something. Like, it may not have been at the inauguration, yes, but it was
not long after. And I suspect those remarks were quite intentional because she was, although she hated politics, she was very circumspect, and she and George were very meticulous about any conversation or correspondence that could be deemed political or diplomatic. So for example, in 1798, she wrote a letter to Henrietta Liston, who was the wife of the British minister to the United States. And George Washington wrote out the response, a draft, and then she copied it out in her hand. So they were colluding on what she would say to basically a harmless letter, but it could be deemed partisan or political or diplomatic. And so my guess is those remarks were very intentional.
Yeah, interesting. Your book says that Adams was responsible for some very, very important precedents that set the tone for what would come after. And so part of it, if I understand it correctly, is that people weren't sure whether, you know, because yes, Washington created a lot of precedents, but would they be followed by anybody who wasn't Washington? Because his stature was so incomparable that maybe it was the case that, well, Washington could do it, but nobody else could. Is that, is that right? And then Adams sort of gave the signal that no, the president can fire a cabinet member. It doesn't have to be Washington.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think some context is so helpful here. This was a world of monarchs and military dictators in which power was often embodied in the physical person of one being. It wasn't necessarily in an office. And so when you had hereditary passing down of power from one monarch to the next, there's a lot of religious connotation, there's a lot of divine right that is folded into those things that gives power to this person who's on the throne. They were unfamiliar with a government or an institution or an office that had the power contained in the office, not necessarily in the person. And so that was something that Americans had to be taught how to participate in, how to respect, and how to uphold. And for Washington, it was complicated because before he even became president, people were already calling him the father of the country. So he had a lot of that personal prestige in a way that no other president has ever had since. And, you know, that kind of language almost feels uncomfortable to us today because we are so unwilling. Most of us are so unwilling to celebrate politicians in that type of way. Mm-hmm. And the closest that I can think of is like Dolly Parton is kind of universally beloved, but she's obviously not a political figure. So imagine someone who is that universally loved, but also the most powerful office. It was a combination that was never going to be able to be recreated. And so Adams' challenge was to prove that the office mattered. It wasn't necessarily about the person. And Washington helped him in that way. When Adams was inaugurated, after the inauguration, he walked out of the building and Washington walked out behind him. And it was the first time in probably about 30 years that Washington had walked out of the room behind another man, which was an enormous symbolic gesture that he was just a citizen now, like everyone else, and the office was bigger than him. So a lot of that theater had to go into this learning process for the American people. And then I mentioned that, you know, when Adams fired Pickering in May of 1800, that legal precedent is essential because if secretaries can't be fired, if they can pursue whatever agenda they want, then it splits the executive into an executive by committee, essentially like a privy council like you have in Britain, where the other members of the cabinet have their own base of authority. And so in firing Pickering, not only was Adams removing an enormous thorn in his side, but he was also defending the character of the executive as Washington had established it.
The descriptions in the book of this cabinet are just unbelievable. So the cabinet was really small then, okay? But these guys are just, they're treating Adams like a factotum. Like, you can stay home in Quincy, we'll handle everything. You know, I mean, they really, and they were just defying his orders outright. And it was completely unclear who was in charge, right? I mean, for a while.
Yeah. And it, you know, it blows my mind because it's one thing if someone like Jefferson, who at least had diplomatic experience, was sort of claiming this authority. But what I find so befuddling about Timothy Pickering is Timothy Pickering thought he was the smartest person in the room all the time.
He was a Secretary of State.
Yes. And he, I mean, think about some of the rooms that he was, who he was with. I mean, he was with people like Hamilton and Jefferson and Adams and Washington, and he thought that he was smarter all the time. And he had never left the country. So he was trying to establish foreign policy and had no diplomatic experience whatsoever. I also find it, you know, really interesting. Hamilton and Adams despised each other. They hated each other. And they had a major clash over foreign policy too. And Hamilton was lecturing Adams on what was going to happen in France and what was going to happen in London. And he had never been to those places. And I can just imagine the rage boiling up in Adams' head at this nobody who was, you know, lecturing him about things he had nothing about.
And you tell one of the stories. I remember this from the book where you said, I think it was Hamilton who was saying, Louis XVIII is going to be on the throne in a couple weeks, right? Isn't that one of the stories?
And yeah, so this like, was in, no. He's like, that's not how this is going to work. And it was in 1799. And Adams was, no, it was, 1799. And Adams was getting ready to send this diplomatic mission to France to try and negotiate a peaceful settlement. And Hamilton comes to see him and is trying to convince him not to send the peaceful settlement because he says Louis XVIII is going to be back on the throne any day and will give them better terms. Well, for those of you who are familiar with your French history, Louis XVIII does, I mean, the Bourbon kings are eventually restored, but it doesn't go very well for them. And it takes a long time to get to that point. And so it just showed a real lack of understanding about European dynamics, which Adams had firsthand experience with and knew quite well.
He had been a diplomat himself. He also had some diplomats abroad that reported directly to him, so, you know, bypassing Pickering. And those were his son, John Quincy Adams, and the other one's name, who was the one in The Hague?
William Vansmurry, who was a friend of John Quincy Adams was a very savvy diplomat in his own right. And yes, they were both absolutely giving him information. They were sending it to the Secretary of State as they were supposed to, but they were also sending it directly to Adams, not trusting Secretary of State Timothy Pickering to pass it along.
Which was fair, because Pickering did sometimes put things in a bottom drawer. By the way, I love the picture in the book of the young John Quincy Adams, because you always see the picture of the elderly guy, who I respect tremendously because of what he did. I mean, I love John Quincy, but anyway, he chose to become a congressman after having served as president, and he was a great voice for abolition to the point where they actually gagged him in Congress. But he's always shown old. And in the picture of him as a young man, he was quite handsome, I have to say.
He was, and he was apparently pretty charming. He loved poetry. He loved the theater. He had a great taste in music. He could be prickly, but he could be quite charming when he wanted to be.
And he was apparently brilliant. Like, he knew Latin and Greek at a very young age. And
so admittedly, he is the subject of my next book. And
which
you very lovely preempted. It was a wonderful way to introduce it. And he is quite a source of, has been a source of fascination for quite some time. I don't know if anyone saw my dog come in. His name is John Quincy Dog Adams.
And you thanked him in the acknowledgments. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody thank their dog in the acknowledgments section.
He's the best writing advice. Getting a dog is the best writing advice I can give to anyone. But yes, John Quincy was utterly brilliant. He spoke like five languages by the time he was 12. And because I'm a terrible linguist, and had his own diplomatic appointment when he was 14 to go to Russia to serve as a French translator for the envoy to Russia. So he just was a remarkable human.
Yeah. By the way, one of our readers, speaking of John Quincy, says, this is from Charles Michaels. He says, can Lindsay Chervinsky settle a longstanding argument that he has with his wife? He says, were both John Adams and John Quincy Adams born in Braintree?
Yes, they both were. They were born in houses right next to each other. So John Adams was born in one house and then came back and lived in the house right next door with Abigail when they were newlyweds. And that was where John Quincy was born, which must have been really fun for Abigail to live right next to her mother-in-law. I'm sure she really enjoyed that.
By the way, I love the references to places that are still here. So at one point you're describing Adams coming to Alexandria, which is just down the road from me here. And you mentioned Gadsby's Tavern, which is still there. So anybody who comes to the D.C. area, if you go to Alexandria, Gadsby's Tavern is still there. Okay. So we talked about a number of relationships. Now I wanted to get to Jefferson and Adams. When we were preparing this podcast and discussion with you, One of my colleagues said, you know, oh, somebody wrote, one of the readers wrote in and mentioned that both died on the same day, on July 4th, 1826, Adams and Jefferson. And this was the first she had heard about it, and she thought it was so cool. And so why don't we talk about that for a minute? Because this relationship was so fascinating. The fact that they went from friends to real, pretty much enemies, to friends again at the end of their lives. Can we just spend a minute on that? And then, of course, the fact that they both died on July 4th, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, same day, was taken at the time as providential, right? I mean, people thought this was a sign from God that he loved this republic, right?
Yeah, you really can't make this up. If you did and tried to pitch it to a movie producer, I think you'd be laughed out of the room. So history is sometimes more interesting than fiction. So when John Adams and Thomas Jefferson met at the Continental Congress, he both engineered Washington's appointment as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, and then he engineered Jefferson's authorship of the Declaration of Independence. And at that point, he was definitely more of the senior partner in the friendship, and they worked together in Congress for a while, and then they both had their own separate diplomatic appointments. Adams went abroad first for several years while Jefferson was governor of Virginia, and then Jefferson joined him. And they were very close. They were almost family, to the point where John Quincy Adams really thought of Jefferson as sort of the young, fun uncle who would take him to the opera and was really a part of their family unit. That relationship started to fracture a bit when they came back to the United States for Washington's administration. And it largely fractured out of the different conclusions they drew from their time in Europe. So they both believed that the United States was at that point an exceptional nation, but they drew different conclusions. Thomas Jefferson believed that the United States was not yet characterized by the corruption and cronyism and sin of Europe because the United States had an exemplary character and it was more virtuous and therefore would not become like the European nations. Adams believed that we were less corrupt and had less cronyism and certainly more transparency so far, and that we just hadn't gotten there yet, but that certain efforts had to be made to prevent against that corruption. Otherwise, we would inevitably fall to it, just like European nations had. And so there, I confess, I'm in the Adams camp, not in the Jefferson camp on this. I think Adams had a much more pragmatic view of humans Jefferson did.
Absolutely.
Jefferson had a wonderful, maybe wonderful way of being able to think about humanity in one plane and then actually interact with humans on another. And they didn't seem to meet up with one another. So the relationship started to get a little bit tense during the Washington administration when Adams was quite supportive of Washington policy. And Jefferson, of course, was critical of it. They were then facing off against each other in 1796. That was a contentious election, but not nearly as bad as the one 4 years later. They really stopped speaking about halfway through the presidency, especially when the quasi-war with France made domestic tensions quite bad. And
Jefferson was colluding with the French ambassador, right?
Yeah, Jefferson gets remarkably close to treason as vice president. And this part of his tenure is often swept under the rug. So when he was vice president, he met with the French minister and he told the French minister not to sign a treaty with the Adams administration, because Jefferson would be in office a couple of years later and would give him much better terms. So what he was basically saying is that the French Navy should continue to assault American shipping, and it was fine if they could just wait for a couple of years. If there had been a declaration of war, that's treason. So not great as vice president. After Jefferson won the election in 1800 and that transition, they then did not speak for 11 years. And their re-engagement was engineered by a shared friend, Benjamin Rush, who loved them both. And Adams was the first to send a letter. He extended an olive branch. And then over the next 14 years, they exchanged 99 letters. Adams definitely wrote the bulk of them, but he said, I know you have more letters to write, so I'm very happy to write more to you, and you can respond whenever you see fit. And what made this correspondence so remarkable was that Adams could talk to Jefferson about things that few other people could. He talked to him about slavery. He talked to him about grief. He made Jefferson talk about his feelings, which Jefferson hated. They talked about the future of the nation. And they talked about their shared reminiscences about the founding of the Republic. I think some of that was produced by the fact that most of their peers were dying. And so it was a rare person that they could speak to who had lived through the same thing. They had a lot of the same interests and a lot of the same reading. And so they did have a lot to speak about. And it's a really remarkable correspondence. Jefferson's letter to Adams after Abigail died is probably one of the most beautiful letters he had ever written. It's exquisite in its simplicity, and the sympathy genuinely shines through. And then, as you said, they died on July 4th, 1826. You can't make up this story. And it is such a remarkable moment in human history because it was seen as providential. It was after the first major sectional crisis in 1820 over slavery. They were among the last of the founders to die. And it was really the ending of, I think, an era. An interesting historical tidbit, to this past week, Mel Brooks turned 100. His birth was closer to the death of Jefferson and Adams on July 4th, 1826, than to July 4th, 2026.
Yeah. Our history.
Isn't that crazy?
I
read
short.
That fact yesterday and I was just like, oh my gosh.
I know. I remember sitting around the table at Thanksgiving one year and my older relatives were saying, well, my grandfather was alive when Lincoln was assassinated, you know, that kind of thing. And you're like, wow, our history is so short.
Yeah. It's just, if you look at the, if you look at the generations that have passed, it's basically four generations gets us back to the revolution. And that is really just not very many.
That's crazy. All right. Now, so Adams did many things right. And you, I think, argue very persuasively that his presidency doesn't get enough credit by history. It's kind of ignored, even by the people who are big Adams boosters, like, you know, David McCullough and the others mm-hmm. who've written books about him. They sort of, you know, the presidency, and then they have to deal with the Alien and Sedition Acts. Now, the Alien and Sedition Acts have recently been in the news again. So, I'd love to hear you on the subject of the laws. This was something that wasn't Adams's idea, but he did acquiesce, right? And mm-hmm. did he, I mean, so do you think it was one of his worst errors? And by the way, Abigail seems to have yes. played, you point this out in the book, she was pushing for it.
Yes.
Just interesting.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Yes. So I will confess, when I wrote this book, I was thinking that the Sedition Act would be the one that would be the most relevant. I was not expecting the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to be a topic of news.
Yeah.
Bit of context. There are actually four bills. They were all passed by Congress. And in the 1790s, Congress really took the initiative with legislation. Today, we expect the president to sort of have a legislative agenda that Congress either rejects if they're of a different party or they try and push through if they're of the same party. That was not how it worked in the 1790s at all. So Congress passed four bills. There was a naturalization bill that made it much harder to become a citizen because immigrants tended to vote for Democratic Republicans. There was the Alien Enemies Act, which was actually put forward initially by Republicans because they wanted to try and preempt a more radical measure. And they understood that in the time of war, maybe there would be some additional security measures that would be taken. And this was seen as a very pragmatic wartime measure because It required Congress to declare war. It required the president to issue a proclamation. And then it required judicial proceedings for each person to be deported. So it required the participation of all three branches and thus was acceptable to the Democratic Republicans. And they put it forward. It did not go far enough for the Federalists, so they passed an Alien Friends Act, which allowed the president to deport basically anyone at will. Then the last bill was the Sedition Bill, and this was the bill that made it a crime to criticize the president or Congress, notably leaving out the vice president, who was Thomas Jefferson. It was very partisan in its intention, as was the Naturalization Act. It was implemented in a partisan fashion. And as you said, Adams did not ask for any of these bills, but he did sign them. Now, critically, he did not ever use the authority granted to him under the Alien Friends Act. I think he felt that it went too far. So that's at least sort of an acknowledgement that that bill was inappropriate. The Sedition Bill is more complicated. There were some newspaper editors he really didn't like who were very mean to him, and he didn't mind their prosecutions. So it is without a doubt the dark mark on his presidential legacy. I never wish to suggest otherwise. Abigail was absolutely encouraging of it. This is another one of those moments that those who trespass against our loved ones sometimes receive harsher treatment from us, and that was certainly true. But I do think there's one element of it that, in addition to the fact that it was very much Congress pushing for it, that sometimes legal commentators miss when they're talking about it today, which is that the jurisdiction that limits our First Amendment protection rights today did not exist back then. So today we have not a clear understanding, because there are obviously lots of debates about the First Amendment, but we understand that speech designed to invoke violence is not protected under the First Amendment. You know, the famous, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, for example.
Falsely.
none of that was on the books yet. And political speech in newspapers was asking and calling for violence, and people were responding. So newspaper editors would call for mobs to attack their enemies, and they did. And there were threats of arson in Philadelphia. Death threats were delivered to the president's house. And so I think there was a genuine good faith concern about the role of political speech and violence, but it was then used by the Federalist Party and perverted for partisan gain. And so I think it's really essential that we don't dismiss the fear, because that is something I think some of it we can identify with. We just can't allow it to be thwarted in that way.
And speaking of that fear, one of the scenes in the book is of a mob that assembles outside John Adams's residence in Philadelphia, the president's house, where he estimated there were 10,000 people, and they were wearing the different cockades depending on whether they were supporters of France or opponents. And some of them were, you know, they thought there was a genuine fear that they might attack the president's house. And they, you know, Adams himself, as well as other people in the household, had to run and get guns and stand by the windows. And then you say, well, you tell the story. Then they called out the militia, right?
Yeah, they did. You know, and this is before there was a Secret Service. There was no gate outside the president's house, so people could just walk up to the front door. Adams had sent some of his secretaries through a back alley to the Department of War offices, which were just a couple blocks down, to bring over ammunition and guns to sort of barricade the windows. Thankfully, the city and the state government called up the militia and the cavalry to disperse the crowds, which they did. So there wasn't any violence inflicted upon the president's house or the president. But what is so interesting is later that this was kind of poo-pooed as not an actual threat. But that night, Jefferson wrote in his letters that it wasn't safe to go outside. So this was a fear of violence in the city. And this was at the sort of height of the anti-French fervor, when it was unclear if there was going to be a French invasion. So tensions were palpable. There was a widespread concern that violence was likely and shared by people of multiple parties.
At the same time there was palpable fear, there was also a level of hysteria, which is reminiscent of the 21st century. I think this was in the John Freeze case, where, you know, these people were protesting a law that put a tax on their houses. That ought to be very familiar to early Americans objecting to taxes. But they blow this up into a treason trial just because they had been protesting. Now, they did have guns, and there was a little bit of an ambiguity about the situation, but there was this huge overreaction. And a justice of the Supreme Court, of all things, presides over a treason trial for these people. And he tells the jury that obstructing a federal law amounts to high treason. I mean, that is a level of hysteria and overreaction that, honestly, I do associate with our politics now.
Yeah, just to sort of set the stage. So the protesters had petitioned for redress and basically said that they thought that this tax was unconstitutional. And so they were under the impression that therefore it was not in effect and they didn't have to pay the tax. It's not actually how taxes work. It's not how bills work. So they were incorrect. And some were rounded up. And then a larger group went and sort of sprung those people free from detention. Now, when Adams sent out the militia to basically crush that rebellion, the only casualty was a cow who had startled one of the soldiers into thinking that it was sort of a rebelling force, and the cow was shot. So
it was a rebellious not a cow.
It was a rebellious cow, but this was not a particularly violent insurrection. And many of the people who were participating had been veterans of both the Revolution and had mustered with George Washington when he suppressed the Whiskey Rebellion. So many of these people were Federalists. They just thought that the tax was extreme. Adams had thought the tax was extreme. He had warned against it when it was raised in 1798. And this tax was raised to pay for this big partisan army. So when the cases came to court, again, this is a case where so much is unwritten, and so many of the ways that judges are supposed to comport themselves today in terms of how you manage jury proceedings and jury instructions and judicial code of ethics, none of those things were written down. And the way this Supreme Court justice managed this case, if you read the transcript, it is insane. He basically says, like, this person is guilty. That is the only thing that you can decide. Give me the verdict. So they did. They gave a guilty verdict, and he was sentenced to death. This is John Freeze and a number of the other co-conspirators. And Adams, both in following Washington's precedent of having granted a pardon to many of the Whiskey Rebellion rebels, and also as a good lawyer, was a little bit worried about establishing a precedent for treason that was basically disagreeing with a federal bill. And so he contemplated giving pardons and was sort of delayed by a retrial, and then ultimately did end up pardoning all of them. And that was, again, very partisan because the extreme Federalists wanted to make an example of these people who had protested against a federal law.
Okay, now we have to come to the hero of Broadway. We've got to talk about Hamilton. because he is... Wow. Brilliant. One of the most brilliant founders, I have to say. And I've read quite a few of his essays and, you know, the Federalist Papers. Brilliant. On the other hand, when Adams was president, I mean, he was probably the chief instigator of all kinds of shenanigans and plots against Adams. And one of the things that he does is really, beyond trying to undermine Adams, arguably was attempting to undermine the voting system. So this was in 1800, where Adams is eventually is going to face Jefferson and Burr and others. But anyway, the New York legislature had just elected a bunch of Republicans. Well, you tell it. I'm not going to do as good a job.
Yeah. So the important thing to know about Hamilton is, yes, he was absolutely brilliant, but he was also nuts. And when Washington wasn't above him to sort of restrain the craziness, he went off the rails. That's the only way to explain this. And he had such visions of sort of military grandeur and ideas about glory. And I think as he started to see them slip through his fingers, he just became more and more insane with his plots. So in the election of 1800, as is today, the Constitution specifies that each state gets to determine how its electors are apportioned. Some states had separate elections for those electors. Some states had the state legislature decide. Some had a mix. So the election of 1800 was actually a series of interlocking elections over the course of the year. And in the state of New York, the state legislature was going to determine the electors, which meant whoever won the state legislature elections was going to basically determine the presidential election. And the state legislature election basically pitted Hamilton and Burr against one another. Burr came out on top. The state legislature was controlled by Republicans. But there was a window before they were actually put into office. And Hamilton wrote to John Jay, who was the governor of New York at the time. He was the outgoing governor. And he said, you have a window in which you can change how these votes are decided. You can have them decided a different way such that it will remain the control of the Federalists. Yes, it is a rather unusual measure, but desperate times call for desperate measures. Basically, I'm paraphrasing the last bit.
I've actually got the quote right here. Perfect. The scruples of delicacy and propriety ought to yield to the extraordinary nature of the crisis.
Okay, so he writes this to John Jay, and John Jay takes one look at it and recognizing, you know, his party is going to lose power here. John Jay was no fan of Thomas Jefferson. He understood what this meant, and he basically said no. And refused to go along with this plot. And it was, again, one of these moments of what I define as civic virtue, of putting the Constitution or the Republic above one's own partisan interests. And there were a series in the year of 1800 that made the Republic survive. But it's a demonstration of how kind of in the deep end Hamilton had gone.
You, I think, would put Jay in the pantheon of people who did put country above party, right?
Yeah.
And Adams. Yes. Anybody else who you think deserves mention?
Well, I think there were a couple of figures in the crisis during the transition when they were trying to figure out who was actually going to win the election. And this was when the votes were deadlocked in the House of Representatives. Then, as is now, if the election is undecided or tied, it is thrown to the House and each state gets one vote, not each representative. So it was deadlocked. And there were two members. One was James Bayard of Delaware, and one was Samuel Smith of Maryland. They were Federalists and Democratic Republicans, respectively, but they were of the moderate wings of their party. And they were the ones that engineered the compromise that allowed Jefferson to win on the 36th ballot. That compromise was essential. And then while I think at times he comported himself very poorly in the election of 1800, I do give Jefferson a smidge of credit for his first inaugural address, in which he wrote, "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists, not every difference of opinion is a difference of principle." And that was the first time a president had used an inauguration to extend an olive branch to the other side to demonstrate that they were really the leader of the entire nation. Adams hadn't had to do so because the election wasn't nearly as contentious as the election of 1800. And in doing so, I think Jefferson proved to many Federalists, including people like John Marshall, that he did intend to govern in a more moderate way, which for the most part he did. And he established that expectation, which most presidents have adhered to, that starting at your inauguration, you govern all Americans. You don't govern your party. And you are intended to speak and lead as though you represent all of us.
I don't know if you agree, but I'll say a word on behalf of Hamilton here, too, because when it did come down to a contest between Jefferson and Burr, and Hamilton, of course, loathed Jefferson, and they had been at daggers drawn throughout the Washington presidency and all of that. But when it came down to that, Hamilton said, nope. Burr has no principles and he's a bad human being. And even though I disagree with Jefferson, I think he would, you know, we have to prefer him to Burr, right?
Yes, and I totally agree. And it was, I think his influence in that outcome is overstated, but I do think it mattered. And he was right. I think Burr would have been a very dangerous person to have in office.
One of our readers asks, and this I guess would be a great final question, what is your sense of the lasting impact of Adams's career? This was from Christy Lambert. Oh, by the way, before you answer that, just so you know, Jonathan St. Clair says you're one of my favorite authors and historians. Hopefully you'll make it up to Anchorage soon. So there you go. An invitation to Anchorage is on the way.
That's incredibly kind. I can't say that Anchorage is on my current agenda, but I would be very open to it if the right opportunity presented itself. That's wonderfully kind. Thank you. Adam's lasting impact. It's hard to say because he was involved in so much. He was so essential to independence being declared. He was really, he was the bulldog and the nag that Congress needed to actually get it over the line, because he pushed and prodded and poked and cajoled and yelled and did all the things to get people on his side. He selected Washington. He ensured that he was the commander in chief. He ensured Jefferson was the writer of the Declaration of Independence. He played a critical role as a diplomat. He wrote the model treaty after which most treaties were modeled during the early Republic. He secured an essential loan from the Netherlands. But I think as president, you know, and I either had the pleasure and benefit or insanity to follow David McCullough writing about John Adams. But the thing about most biographers of John Adams is that they wrote those biographies before January 6th. And history is written depending on the questions we ask. And the questions we ask depend on the things we've seen and the experiences we've had. And so I think it's easy to dismiss the peaceful transfer of power if you've never seen a contested transition, because you just assume that it will always be that way. And yet we have seen that's not the case. And it is also at the same time what it means to be a republic. And Adams and Washington, and to a certain extent Jefferson, understood that the American people had to be taught that this was important, and they had to be taught how to do it. And that contribution, I just think, is timeless and cannot be appreciated enough.
I think we might have skipped over one little thing that I think it fleshes out what you've just said. Could you just describe the way Adams handled the transition to Jefferson, mm-hmm. the way he...
Adams knew he was going to lose before the election really even happened. And then it was a tie between Jefferson and Burr, and it was deadlocked for several months. And he did something that we so rarely appreciate in presidents. He demonstrated restraint. He invited Jefferson to a private meeting at the White House. He assured him that Adams believed Jefferson was the rightful choice, the people's choice, that ultimately Congress would get there, but that he would play no role in the Federalist schemes. He would not run for election again if they managed to postpone the election past March 4th. And that when there was a transition, he would do everything in his power to make it a smooth one. And then he kept his word. Once Jefferson was selected on the 36th ballot, he instructed his cabinet secretaries to give Jefferson briefings and to not make any major decisions without talking to him. Both of those things are now mandated by statute as part of the transition process, but was absolutely not required at the time. And then he went home. And I think that he gets a bad rap for this because we now expect outgoing presidents, even if they've lost, to attend inaugurations. But that expectation, that precedent, was not established until 1845. And while Washington's presence at Adams' inauguration had been enormously helpful, Jefferson didn't ask Adams to be there. Adams, I think, worried, and rightfully so, that his presence might be a distraction, would make it harder to turn the page. There was no precedent of this happening at the state level. I was not able to find any record that outgoing governors attended the inaugurations of their predecessors, or sorry, their successors. And critically, no one criticized Adams for it at the time. That criticism didn't come until much, much later. So he went home. Again, this was not done at the time. This is the age of Napoleon. People, you know, didn't give up power willingly. It was a radical thing to do. And then he wrote back to Jefferson, you know, I wish you a safe and happy administration. Everything is peaceful here. And that sets the tone for what we want transitions to be. And he did so long before it was really required by statute.
Now, my last question, which is, as you survey, we are now in the week of our 250th birthday as a country. You've immersed yourself thoroughly in our history. Obviously, we are going through a very rough patch, and a lot of people, if you look at the Pew poll about the people who feel gratified or feel very proud to be American is at a very low ebb. And honestly, I'll just speak for myself really briefly and just say, I would rather see that kind of a poll response than to see a poll response that says, yes, you know, USA all the way, because it shows a certain amount of reflection. It shows an awareness that this isn't the greatest moment for our country. Mm-hmm. But I think you build on that and that there's certain recognition of shame, but that anyway, so that's my reaction. Tell me about yours on this 250th anniversary.
I agree with that. I think it's a really insightful way to look at those numbers. I take comfort from the fact that every anniversary that we've had, whether it was 50, 100, 150, 200, they tend to come at moments when things aren't going so great in the United States. They tend to come in decades that are very tense, that have sectional division or violence or racial violence or polarization. Certainly 1976 was in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate and horrible inflation, and you know, trust in institutions was at an all-time low. But there are moments, there are opportunities for people to try and come together, to be re-inspired by what the nation, the ideas the nation was founded upon, and the opportunity, the incredible opportunity that we've been gifted through that inheritance to try and make the nation more perfect with each passing generation. I think that is the actual lasting legacy of the founders, that they were trying a bunch of stuff. It was an experiment. They called it that, but they desperately hoped that future generations would continue to experiment, would not treat what they started as the end point, but rather as a foundation to build upon. And so if we could view this moment as, you know, we're going to have a series of anniversaries for the next 11 years that lead us up to the 250th of the Constitution. What if, as we are thinking about the revolution and what it means to have independence with the Treaty of Paris and then the Constitutional Convention, what if we took this next decade and had our own civic renaissance? What changes could we implement to try and make the nation just a little bit more perfect? Past anniversaries have inspired similar reform, and so I like to be hopeful that maybe this one would too.
Lindsay Chervinsky, the fact that you are doing what you do makes me hopeful. So
thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks everyone who wrote in and who watched this afternoon. Thank you very much.